Welcome to Act and Unwind, an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. I'm your host, Eric Cohn. I want to thank you for listening. I want to ask that if you're listening to us on our website, that you navigate right now to the show notes for this episode, because that's where you'll find a link to subscribe directly to Act and Unwind at Apple Podcasts, monopolists that they are, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else where you listen to fine podcasts. And if you like this program, please leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts so as to help more people find our show. This week, I'm joined by Anthony Bradley, Distinguished Research Fellow here at Acton, and Dan Huger, Acton's librarian and a research associate. This week, we're talking tech, including pondering whether smartphones are in and of themselves tyrannical, and Elon Musk's brain chip company Neuralink. But first, I want to go to Washington, where the Department of Justice has filed an antitrust action against Apple, primarily over their iPhone product. I will give you some summation here from Axios. The Justice Department and over a dozen state attorneys general filed a civil antitrust lawsuit against Apple in federal court Thursday, accusing it of illegally maintaining a monopoly in the smartphone market. Why it matters? The suit takes the Biden administration's efforts to limit big tech's power to a new level, coming on top of major cases against Google, Meta, and Amazon. The lawsuit, filed in U.S. District Court in New Jersey, specifically accuses Apple of violating Section 2 of the Sherman Antitrust Act, with 16 state and district AGs joining the DOJ in accusing Apple of, quote, broad-based exclusionary conduct, hurting both consumers and competitors. This is the third Department of Justice suit against Apple since 2009. The accusations in this case are that, quote, Apple undermines apps, products, and services that would otherwise make users less reliant on the iPhone and has consolidated its monopoly, quote, not by making its own products better, but by making other products worse. That is according to Attorney General Merrick Garland at a press conference announcing this suit. Some more takeaways here. Apple has, quote, Apple has gone from revolutionizing the smartphone market to smothering it, said Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco. Today's lawsuit seeks to hold Apple accountable and ensure it cannot deploy the same unlawful playbook in other vital markets, said Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cantor in a press release. Quote, each step of Apple's course of conduct built and reinforced the moat around its smartphone technology, the complaint reads. Quote, the cumulative effect of this course of conduct has been to maintain and entrench Apple's smartphone monopoly at the expense of users, developers, and other third parties who helped make the iPhone what it is today. Of course, Apple disagrees with this, as you might imagine. Apple's response said the lawsuit threatens who we are and the principles that set Apple products apart in fiercely competitive markets, Apple said in a statement. Also, quote, if successful, it would hinder our ability to create the kind of technology people expect from Apple, where hardware, software, and services intersect. It would also set a dangerous precedent, empowering government to take a heavy hand in designing people's technology. So, of course, I decided to take a look at some of the actual numbers about smartphone market share. In Q4 of 2023, Apple had 23% of the market share. Samsung had 16%. Various other companies, Oppo, I think it's Xiaomi. I'm not sure if I'm saying that one correct. Vivo, other smaller cell phone or smartphone makers making up another big slice, 13%, 7%, and 7% respectively for those. And then others, 34%. Back up to the previous quarter, Apple's at 16% and Samsung is at 20%. It does not appear as clear to me that they are this dominant player in the market. And in fact, even amongst people in this room, I'm looking over at Dan, and I know you are a green bubble guy, Anthony. You are a green bubble guy as well.
No,
you're an iPhone guy. Okay. I'm an iPhone person. I'm a a big Apple person in general, so you can take my perspective on that as you would like. Again, here I'll give you mobile vendor market share worldwide. According to Stats Counter Global Stats, February 2024, Apple is at 27%, Samsung is at 23%. This Xiaomi at 11%, almost 12%. So I'm unpersuaded, just kind of on its face, that this is some kind of enormous problem. And to me, smacks of the way we have been defining down what a monopoly is. Because anybody who has walked into a cell phone store, so I have T-Mobile as a provider, you can get, and in fact, when I got my now 13-year-old daughter, she got a phone when she turned 13. We purchased a previously used iPhone because we use Apple products, and like the one of the things that Apple pitches there is the way that it meshes perfectly. If you embrace the entire Apple ecosystem, it is very easy to use parental controls over a device that my child or a tablet that my children would be using. So I like that and embrace it. I also got a free other phone. I think it was a Samsung of some kind. They're available, and people seem to be choosing more often than not, although, again, not in the overwhelming way that this seems to make the case for. People generally seem to choose Apple's products, and I fail to see the case for how this is monopolistic behavior. And maybe we'll get into the walled garden way that Apple treats most of its technology. Now, whether that is monopolistic or not, I'm still unpersuaded, but I'm open to hearing arguments on it. Dan, I'll go to you first, since you're our resident green bubble person. I'll come back to the stigma that you must be dealing with, because that was also in this complaint from the Department of Justice, that people with the green text bubbles feel a social stigma that they are not part of the blue bubbles, because I guess blue bubbles matter. But Dan, I will go to you for, do you, one, you can feel free to opine on the stigma you may or may not feel, but as someone who owns a device that is not an Apple smartphone, do you think this is a monopolistic enterprise that Apple's engaged in here?
So I first have to begin with a disclaimer, which is that my grandfather spent his career at IBM. He began in 1956, and they pay him a pension until this day. So we have, as a family, never owned Apple products until, of course, my grandfather got a iPad tablet, for all of the sorts of reasons that you specified that your family chooses such a product. Now, this in regards to the stigma, I was not aware until this story that I indeed appeared differently than other people did on their text messages. So either people have been snickering, you know, behind my back for years, because I do indeed have a Nokia phone that has a very standard operating system. My preference with cell phones is to pay for them in cash and pay less than $200 for them. Nokia fit that bill this time. I have had the Xiaomi, which is what I call them. But I, you know, in light of recent events, I decided to switch to a Scandinavian firm as opposed to a Chinese firm. But these are available, and these are the American market is the most Apple-saturated market there is. Other places of the world, Android predominates.
Yeah, I think the rest of the world is something like Samsung has like 70% market share in the rest of the world, if you exclude the United States. So that's if you know, obviously, this is only an action being brought within the United States. It doesn't necessarily need to reflect what the stats are for the rest of the world. But that is worth noting, I think.
And the other thing worth noting is that monopoly, as it appears in an economics textbook, and monopoly as it appears in American law, are two very different things. Monopoly is not about market share. We have had legal rulings and a legal tradition that has in fact said, even with overwhelming market share, companies can be allowed to exist should they meet certain consumer welfare standards. And there is a body of law and jurisprudence that makes this argument. So for better or for worse, the merits of these things, there's not a clear-cut standard. There's not a clear-cut legal standard. Just because a firm has a even if a firm has a minority market share, they can still and still are prosecuted under these standards because the definition is so nebulous in American law. I don't see how anyone is locked into this any more than they are into other things. And again, part of the sales pitch with Apple is indeed this comprehensive ecosystem. This makes computing accessible to a lot of people who it otherwise wouldn't be. The sort of folks who learned personal computers on a PC Junior, as my grandfather did, now, with the advent of the internet, with a lot of other things going on in personal computing, to have a device that he can go to a retail store location and attend classes with people who can walk him through it step by step. And the reason you can do that is because all of those tablets are the same. They're operating with the same software. This is a service that Apple provides to consumers, and it does come with real trade-offs on the part of consumers, but I don't see that as being unreasonable.
This is the conflict that exists between Apple's two primary co-founders, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. That Wozniak very much is a developer. He's the guy who wants options for his machine. If you watch the Aaron Sorkin scripted movie with Michael Fassbender, is pretty good. I recommend it to people. You see Jobs and Wozniak in there disagreeing about the customizability of the machines that they are building, that Wozniak thinks this is what people want. And Jobs is of an entirely different persuasion that, like, you know, no, we're not going to give all these different slots so that people can lowjack their machines and they can modify them. We're going to provide people with a machine that works reliably. And I would say that that is, as a brand promise of Apple, is one that they do a very good job of delivering on. Of course, it's a complicated piece of technology. There are going to be issues that will arise or can arise with any kind of a machine like that. But again, this is why one of the things that Apple did that was incredible is they didn't just revolutionize the smartphone market. They revolutionized retail when it comes to computing. What you just described, the ability to go into a retail store and have someone explain to you, take classes on how you can use the machine in general, how you can use specific applications that exist on it, are all available to you. So I sympathize with the want to embrace for people who want to embrace that kind of a computing experience, because it does take a lot of the difficulty out of it that comes along to me with PCs. I have a biased perspective on this as someone who's used Apple computers for a long time now, but I got frustrated with the development of Windows over time. I didn't really love it. I think XP was probably the last one that I thought was a really good operating system. I switched not long after that and really haven't looked back. But there's plenty of options both when it comes to computing and when it comes to smartphones that, again, I don't see the antitrust case here.
It may have to do with the fact that in 2012, there were 45.5 million iPhone users. In 2023, there's 136 million iPhone users in the country. And if you follow the news reporting, that seems to be the main talking point. Not so much market share, but just number of users. And everybody wants part of that market share. I mean, they want to be a part of those 136 million users. And if you're on an Android platform, you can't play in the sandbox with Apple. They simply don't allow it. And so the Justice Department, and I'm sure they've been encouraged by some other people, to open up some of their software applications to the rest of the players. When you look directly at the Justice Department's case, they have a press release right on the website. It seems to be that the basis of the case has to do with the fact that you can't use super apps. So something like WeChat, you can't use it on an iPhone. You can't do cloud gaming or cloud streaming on an iPhone. You can't use any other digital wallet other than the Apple Wallet on the iPhone. And if you have a smartwatch that is developed by a non-Apple company, you can't really use it unless you pay some extra fees. And then on top of all of that, there's the green bubble issue and the fact that you can't do a group chat. If somebody in the group chat is archaic and has an Android, right? I mean, that's the bias. Well, oh my gosh, really?
Yes.
Who's the guy in the group chat that doesn't have an iPhone? That's what I always say.
Well, you can have group chats with those people. You just lose some of the iMessage functionality that you have when it's only people who are on iMessage and only people who are using Apple devices. And you know, I'd like to dispense with the green bubble stigma as somebody who has absolutely teased people about that in the past. I got a long run group text that there was one guy that we refused to add to it because he's a green bubble and he would break it. Yeah, it's a source of a little bit of fun, but the idea that this necessitates some kind of legal action from the Department of Justice is just so absurd and insulting that the list of things, Anthony, you were just rattling off are okay, welcome to trade-offs, right? There are trade-offs with different products, especially when it comes to technology. If you want to be able to use a Google Wallet, then get a different smartphone if you're okay with buying again into the ecosystem. Apple is offering a specific promise that is everything is safe within our walled garden, within the sandbox. It is, end-to-end encrypted. It is the best security that we can possibly provide. And the reason that we keep a lot of those super apps out is because of those security concerns. If you don't want to play in that sandbox, that's fine. There are other sandboxes for you to play in.
Yes, and this is one of the reasons why I often laugh at people when they say that, America is capitalists. Actually, it's corporatist. It's protectionistic. And what big companies almost always do nowadays is they use the government and government power and coercion to protect themselves from competition. And it just seems to me that perhaps, again, I am certain that this was encouraged by some other parties. Other companies want a part of this iPhone user base, and they don't have access to this. So what are they doing? They're going to use the government power, the power of the state, to force Apple to be less competitive. Right, and this has become standard. Right, we don't like the fact that there's competition, and we don't want to compete. Right, so we're gonna go to Dad, right, and make us play fair. Make it fair. I don't want to have to compete on the same level, and so therefore, you get a lawsuit by the Department of Justice.
So one of the things that reminded me as I was reading about this story is. One of the things that this is about Apple's ability to extract rents from its software. So this is where, say, app developers are not able to charge consumers directly for their services through those apps, but they have to charge through Apple, and Apple gets a percentage, extracts a rent from that, being just like a landlord would extract a rent from somebody, using their building to run a store. This is a similar sort of thing. And a lot of smaller app development companies wish that that wasn't so. And it's understandable because this takes something away from their bottom line and, they view it as an extractive sort of thing. They are absolutely free to develop on the platform or not develop on the platform. With those considerations in mind, and there are people who do not develop on Apple's platform because they do not want to pay those rents. But there are also other ways in a society that we can put pressure on companies to lower rents. One is by opting out of the system going with an Android phone or another operating system. Another way is for big market players to take a principled stance against rents like this. And last month, there was a great story. Brandon Sanderson, very famous fantasy novelist, one of the best-selling authors in America, released 4 books last year that were sort of surprise novels that he had cooked up during the pandemic. And one of the interesting things he did about those books was not make them available on Audible, which has a much larger market share in the audiobook space than Apple has ever had in either the hardware or the software space. Audible is an according to the economics textbook sort of monopoly, or at least, you know, potentially so. We're talking 90%+ market share. And Sanderson didn't like the rents that Audible was extracting from authors for being on their platform. So he said, you know what, for these books, I'm going to go with some other players, and I'm going to spotlight those players, and I'm going to encourage my fans to download and listen to the books that way. And just this last month, Audible came out and negotiated their rents down. They had read they wanted Sanderson's properties there. They read his complaints. They came to him and said, hey, how about if we come down and we give the authors and the producers this sort of share? It wasn't exactly what Sanderson wanted, but it was a step in his direction. And as a result, he's now making those books available on that platform. So there are real ways that app creators also have leverage in the market. And it's and I would like to see, I mean, that the only, it's not that the only way to address these problems is the government. There are ways that marketplace participants themselves, both consumers and app developers, can get the sort of change that they want to see without this sort of regulatory capture.
What's really fascinating to me is the narrative that's often raised by economists that it's really difficult to get a company to be as big as Apple is without them having some protectionistic influences along the way. That is, perhaps Apple is in one sense saying, well, you guys are hypocrites because you got us here in the first place, right? Now, it would be really fascinating to go back in the story to see at what point did even Apple use the government to keep competition out along the way so that as these products were being developed, they squeezed out that competition, which might have reduced some of those rents in the first place.
We have patents and copyrights in this nation, and this is in our Constitution to incentivize innovation. Now, there are folks who are critical of that system. I am one of them. But every single company operating in the American economy that holds patents, that holds copyrights, is engaged in, this is designed to stifle competition to incentivize innovation. And every single technology company takes advantage of this.
You made a good point a while ago about the legal definitions of antitrust. And if I knew the episode of the podcast to throw in, I would. But the I just commend to anyone who's interested in legal issues, particularly the federal courts and the Supreme Court, to listen to the Advisory Opinions podcast from The Dispatch with Sarah Isger and David French. But they did a deep dive on antitrust law a while back. And I will sum up Sarah Isger's position on it, which is basically it's all made up. It is all just invented. The laws about this, the actual, like the way the statutes are written, are not abundantly clear. And the way that it is used is often as a very blunt tool like this. And it's funny because this is reminding me of the antitrust case against Microsoft for Internet Explorer, which I find funny now. And I think everyone should find funny now because Internet Explorer doesn't exist anymore. It's been replaced with Microsoft Edge, but largely around the time that this antitrust case was happening was when you started to get the growth in alternative web browsers, where you had options like Mozilla Firefox, where you started to get Google Chrome introduced. Netscape was still available as an option. In fact, a place I used to be. The website for this organization could only be updated through Netscape. You had to have Netscape in order to update the website. Not a great design characteristic, and that was eventually fixed. But to me, the biggest threat to Apple is the fact that they have not been nearly as innovative a company in the last decade or so as they were in the decade that preceded it. And you don't know exactly how much of that you can chalk up to the just unique force of nature that was Steve Jobs. If you've never read the biography, the Isaacson biography of Jobs, I commend it to everyone. It is a fascinating story. He's a fantastically interesting and complicated person. But the innovation that Apple created over that time was pretty incredible. And the new versions of the iPhone as they come out are some small tweaks around the edges and some, you know, neat newer services. And there's this, I can't remember the name for it, but it's in, I think it was what has to do with microprocessors, that basically the you move along very slowly over time, making them slightly better and slightly better and slightly better and slightly better. And there's a period where there's just a big jump where basically the computing power of them doubles, like, practically overnight. And then it goes back to being very small incremental improvements. Maybe we're just in one of those in-between periods. But I think the opportunity is clearly there for someone to threaten Apple's position in this market by being more innovative and creative than they are currently being. But again, I don't see the case for how this is something that needs the government to come in and act in order to ratchet down the number of people who use iPhones at a greater cost to them, as you noted, Dan, primarily because they think they're better. Like, I just don't know the massive dissatisfaction that exists out there with the fact that people are forced, quote unquote, to be iPhone users when, one, they're not being forced, and two, people seem to largely be embracing it freely.
What's really fascinating is if you look at the language of Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, it's fascinating to me that the assumption is that the government has the right categories to define what consumer welfare is for the rest of us. And this is so strange. It's actually kind of funny. Consumers should not have to pay higher prices because companies violate antitrust laws. Now, what's interesting, right, is who gets to define what antitrust is? But then he says this: we allege that Apple has maintained monopoly power in the smartphone market and not simply by staying ahead of the competition on merit, but by violating federal antitrust law. If unchallenged, Apple will only continue to strengthen its smartphone monopoly. The Justice Department will vigorously enforce antitrust laws that protect consumers from the higher prices and fewer choices. This is the Justice Department's legal obligation. And what the American people expect and deserve, he says. Right? So it's fascinating, right? Apple has monopoly power, which is patently false. Secondly, if unchallenged, Apple will only have more monopoly power, also false. So what's happening? Some bureaucrats have decided that their definition of consumer welfare and their definition of monopoly grants them permission to determine what Apple can and cannot do. It has no standards or no basis in the law. It's just what they've decided, right? And so here we have this antitrust case and the fear-mongering, right? If we leave this alone, if the government doesn't step in, Apple will be unhinged. And then we'll all suffer.
Apple is no longer a leading edge technology company. This is the other thing that people, year over year stock value is down. Microsoft, you know, the leading technology that everybody's talking about now that's going to be the next big thing, AI, Apple has nothing to do with.
There's actually some talk about whether they would be including Google Gemini on iPhones, which was the AI that got a lot of flack in the recent weeks, because if you asked it to produce, you know, a picture of the founding fathers of the United States of America, it would look like a United Colors of Benetton ad because of the way that the AI was written and informed. So they may be actually, strangely enough, coming in to bail out Google in Google's attempt at building AI. But yes, and this is, we should also interject that this has not been reported. The conversation we had last week about banning TikTok, if ByteDance were to divest, there are only a handful of companies out there that could really seriously potentially acquire TikTok as a platform, as an application. Again, a lot of them are the ones that I listed earlier in those, you know, huge technology companies that have been subject to a lot of the Biden administration going after big tech companies. But, you know, Amazon could acquire it. Google could acquire it. Meta could acquire it. I don't know how big the Department of Justice is going to be on them, all these social media giants acquiring another enormous social media platform. But the one company that is not in the social media game is Apple, who would have who could afford to acquire it and could theoretically be interested in acquiring it.
Yeah. This is a dynamic market. And one of the interesting things is you look back and some of these folks in the Justice Department and with Linda Kahn and the FTC, they point to the Microsoft government antitrust case. And then they say basically all technological development since is due to the successful prosecution of this antitrust case, which is on its face just ridiculous. Is it's like, you know, there is a place for, you know, regulation in any commercial society, but it does not drive innovation. That takes market actors to do that.
I want to zoom out. This is really not as much a topic number two as perhaps a topic 1B for this morning, but I came across this essay in National Affairs, which is a fantastic journal that I commend to people. I am a subscriber. This is Yuval Levin's publication at the American Enterprise Institute and the really inheritor of the mantle from the Public Interest, if people are familiar with that magazine, Irving Kristol's publication. It is a very interesting and serious journal of ideas. And I say all of that as a bit of throat clearing to bring up this piece, which appears in the spring 2024 issue entitled The Soft Tyranny of Smartphones by Brad Littlejohn and Claire Morell, both of whom I believe are at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Yes, they are. This was a really goofy piece to me. I find there's multiple different arguments that are going on in it. A lot of it to me is not necessarily supportive of the thrust of the piece that you get from the headline, that there is this soft tyranny of smartphones. The argument at the outset is there's an increasing number of things that you can't do if you don't have a smartphone. So I have a friend who has a dumb phone, you know, your kind of standard old mid-aughts, like flip phone. You can text and you can make phone calls, but there's a camera of some sort on it, but it doesn't do the multitude of things that the iPhone I'm currently holding in my hand does. And those are people who have opted out of that style of phone. The thing is that just not a lot of people have chosen that. And I don't know if these two authors are trying to make some kind of like a Marxian false consciousness argument. But if you track the percentage of people, of American people who have cell phones, go back to 2011, 87% of people have a cell phone of some kind. The 35% of them were smartphones. the gap has closed to almost nothing. 92% of people have a cell phone. 97%, 92% have smartphones, and this is in January of 2023. So people have largely chosen this. Now, some of the things that are detailed in this piece do sound to me like annoyances. I'm not a huge fan of the QR code menus that exist at restaurants. However, in almost every case where I have asked for some kind of a physical menu, they have been able to provide me one. They gave an example of parking in Washington, D.C., where there's a parking attendant whose only job was to text a link to people so that they could pay for the parking on their smartphone. And I have not seen here in Grand Rapids or in Chicago very many, if any, parking facilities like this. Almost all of them, while they are now largely unmanned in that there's not somebody at a booth when you enter and exit, there are machines where you can pay using a credit card, or some of them even still, I don't know if you're aware of this, take cash and will let you pay with greenbacks, with actual physical dollars, if you would really like to. They go through a number of things like this before going off onto what to me is a very different argument about, do we overuse smartphones? Are our faces in front of screens too much? Are there mental health problems that are we're seeing manifest, especially among young people? And I am more and less sympathetic to the thrusts of those arguments depending on the specificity of the argument being made. But that has, again, very little to do, by my lights, with this idea that there's this soft tyranny of having to use a smartphone. I think you absolutely, I found it weird to me, again, I will stop monologuing in a moment here, that to me they undermine their own argument in naming minimal phone models like Light Phone, Wise Phone, Boring Phone, Gab Phone, Punked Phone. There are, again, companies offering this to people. The complaint that they seem to have largely is, like, we wish to opt out of this smartphone market, and we're able to, but the vast majority of people disagree with us and they seem very annoyed by that. Am I being unfair in my characterization of the arguments presented in this piece?
No. There are problems with this piece. I mean, the first line, in fact, about what was interesting about the iPhone when it was released. Eric, you've got that
yep.
in front of you. Can you read it?
When Apple unveiled the first iPhone in January 2007, most ordinary consumers rolled their eyes. Why would I need a phone to do all that? Before long, however, Americans were buying smartphones in droves. By 2013, smartphones had overtaken dumb phones in global market share for the first time. They have never looked back.
The reason the iPhone was exciting when it debuted was because it played music and podcasts. What you, dear listeners, are doing right now is probably happening on your phone. And the reason it's happening on your phone is because that is what your smartphone was originally designed to do. This is literally the leading edge. Before there was internet connectivity, remember, all of this used to be synced through iTunes, which was the old Apple iPod. So there's just bad history in this piece. There's just a failure to understand the product. There's also a failure to understand how technology and culture happen. There are certain things. Pocket computing, which is what this smartphone, the internet connectivity, all of this, it is absolutely revolutionary. And I would say it's revolutionary in the same ways that things like mass literacy are revolutionary. Yes, it changes society, but there was no way to opt out of this culture of mass literacy. I mean, there are perhaps hundreds of thousands of people in the world today who are not part of this culture, maybe even millions. But nobody thinks that they deserve public accommodation for this. Now, there are some people that will make the argument, and many, for instance, in the 19th century did, is that this requires an investment in education in both civil society and the public sector because mass literacy is transforming the culture in these ways. So that sort of argument I'm sympathetic to. There's also the instance of like clock time. This is, again, something that transformed the structure of people's existences, something that people cannot opt out of. But nobody considers creating a different regulatory environment for people who want to show up to work and leave whenever. Now, that's not to say that showing up and leaving to work whenever doesn't have merit. That doesn't mean that, like, you know, the written word did obliterate an oral culture that preceded it. These changes happened. There were trade-offs that were made. But when we talk about the language of public accommodation, which is what this piece is talking about, those are things that we have instantiated in law for very different reasons. Obvious example being something like the Americans with Disabilities Act, where we had people that it's not that they are electing to not be able to go up the stairs. It is they cannot go up those stairs. And this also has involved trade-offs. This means that certain sorts of buildings that could be built in the past can no longer be built. This means that those construction costs have to rise. But making space in public spaces and private spaces for people with disabilities is fundamentally different than catering to the preferences of people who simply want to exercise a choice.
Yeah, I was really struck as well by the fact that it seemed to be two arguments conflated into one piece. And what a lot of conservatives of this stripe tend to do is they might have some sort of cultural angst about a particular issue. I think in this case, they might be a bit like Luddites, to be completely honest. So we don't like the fact that we have to use apps to do things. So let's blame it on addiction, and let's blame it on children and pornography, and then we'll use that to really get at what we really want is the fact that I don't want to have to use my phone all the time. Now, here's what's true. If you don't want to use your phone all the time and apps, then don't. Right? I have been a person who silently protested restaurants making me, and I'll say, I don't have my phone. I will leave my phone in the car on purpose, right, to force them to give me a paper menu. You can protest that way if you want, but don't blame it on addiction, and don't place the blame on children just because you don't want the inconvenience of having to use your iPhone, your phone and apps. Now there is a separate argument and discussion we need to make about cell phones and apps and children and education in schools.
Yes.
Because that part of the piece I thought was interesting. As a professor, I've seen an experience where some schools will require students to communicate to their teachers and to the school through an app on a phone. They'll require that. And that to me seems to be a bit of a stretch because it really does disenfranchise people that can't afford those types of phones with the capabilities for those apps. And that to me is a legitimate concern. If we want to have a discussion about those things, we should just talk about those things and don't conflate it with the fact that I have to use an app to park and things like that in a parking lot.
Yeah. This is again where I come back to just the vast number of people who, if they have a mobile phone, have a smartphone. So like, I think it is worth considering that we are talking, the people who wrote this piece are talking about a very small sliver of people. That is not to say that their concerns should be dismissed because it is a small sliver of people. But I think we should have a sense of proportionality that I don't know the mass dissatisfaction that must exist out there, at least, you know, according to if we could consider these people to be and this argument to be representative of a major stream of thought out there. And I just don't think that it is. I just don't see the evidence for that. I think there's, again, this piece is all over the place to me, in that there are some interesting things that I'm in agreement with about hesitations that I have about the impact of social media on young people. I think those are serious arguments that are worth some consideration, although I do have to confess, and I'm hoping to get for an Act in Line podcast, Jonathan Haidt, who has a new book coming out about these trends, that it kind of is very similar to me about like the all the bad things that are happening because of video games and all the bad things that are happening because television is rotting your brain. It's just like the newest version of this argument to me. It's, again, not to say that all the concerns should be dismissed, but it is a very familiar pattern, I would say. There's the question about not only what Anthony was raising about the requirement of using certain apps in school. I think I would generally be okay with a lot of what's been moved online as long as there is some kind of desktop computing analog to the application. You don't just need a smartphone to be able to use it. I think those are legitimate concerns that schools should consider. I don't think people should have phones at all in schooling environments, and I think we are going to see a massive trend towards both public schools and private schools prohibiting people from having phones with them throughout the day. I think that is a trend that we are going to start seeing. But the rest of it, again, just comes off to me as this like litany of small inconveniences that bother people who either have a smartphone and wish that they didn't have to use it as much as they feel that they have to, or who have bought into this alternative dumb phone market. And there are certain things because of the choices that they've made that they can't do that might make life more convenient, or that it's less convenient as a result of having to do it a different way. And I just don't find this to be really all that compelling. And like one of the paragraphs that stuck out to me, again, just because it's an attempt to, again, all analogies fail at some point. This is early on in the piece. Perhaps the best analog, though, is the automobile, a great tool for extending human freedom, yet a peril to freedom if Americans allow their cities to be developed in such a way that no one could survive without a car. Thus, we used public policy to require sidewalks and bike lanes and developed affordable modes of public transportation. As amusing ourselves to death, author Neil Postman wrote, "More important than what a new technology does is what it undoes. Culture always pays a price for technology unless we govern its use." And the notion there at the end that, yes, culture changes over time, and there are always going to be people, sometimes with good reason, sometimes just crankiness, saying, I don't like that things are changing from the way that they used to be. Even within this analogy here, public transportation pre-existed the automobile in various forms. It is just not, again, all that compelling to me. If you want to make an argument about car-centricness in cities and in urban planning, I think there's an argument. I just had Tim Carney on the Act in Line podcast talking about his new book about family unfriendly. I think there are arguments to be made along those lines. I just don't really see their parallel here to the extent that these authors wish to suggest that it exists.
And again, the major problem for me in the piece is it simply infantilizes adults. And it treats, unfortunately, doesn't provide space to cultivate a sense of virtue and maturity and wisdom. It sort of runs along these lines. People aren't wise, and so we need the government to be wise for them. And my approach would be, well, why don't we make people wise and empower people to make decisions so they can opt out of things that aren't good for them? At the conclusion of the essay, they make this point. Some problems are simply too widespread, have gained too much momentum, and are too nearly inescapable for individual families, community institutions, or businesses to overcome them on their own. The soft tyranny of the smartphone is one such problem. I would argue it is not one of those such problems. I'm not convinced that this problem is too widespread for individuals and communities and businesses to overcome on their own, because I believe that people, when they're called to wisdom and virtue and when they're empowered to make those decisions in community, that they have the capacity to do what's best for them, and we don't need the state to sort of be dad in that sense, to make good decisions for the rest of us.
I want to pull one more quote out from the piece here near the end. Quote, a sane public policy response would focus on at least two targets. Smartphone and app developers, by requiring them to make these products far less hazardous and less accessible to children. And the rest of the marketplace, not sweeping at all, by banning businesses and government agencies from limiting access to their services to smartphone users. The best path forward will likely include elements of both. Again, this is two different things that are being lumped together. One I have more sympathy with and one I have a lot less sympathy with. But I have no idea what banning businesses and government agencies from limiting access to their services to smartphone users means or is going to look like, or the methodology through which it is going to actually be accomplished. And again, I would stress these people, the litany of things that are in there are these small inconveniences, like having to pay for parking via a link that was texted to you and things like that. There are ways of opting out of this stuff. If that's what you're really dedicated to, it just betrays to me this, you know, I have decided I wish to live in a certain way, and a lot of other people do not wish to live the way that I have chosen to live, and therefore we must force them to accommodate me, even to the point of embracing the lifestyle that I wish to live. I'm sorry, you've lost me entirely when you're moving in that direction.
For everything to stay the same, everything has to change. This would involve a root, either a superficial compliance. Either you get something like a law that says, all right, if you're under 10, you cannot purchase a cell phone. And then you have misguided parents purchasing those phones for their children anyways, under sort of surreptitious ways. Or in fact, you have just, you know, let's say the legislation is 100% effective. Then you just push back that problem to 11. Or you have, you know, in terms of banning businesses and government agencies from requiring a smartphone, well, they could say, hey, here's our web app. You can access it from a computer or a smartphone or a tablet or any device that you would like. I feel like the authors would not be satisfied with that sort of accommodation. I think what they want is a world before universal internet connectivity. We can have that world. Hosni Mubarak realized it during the Arab Spring when he shut Egypt off from the internet. You can have a public policy response. We could do that in the United States of America tomorrow. Congress could prohibit the internet as such. The problem is everyone realizes that is ridiculous, that it's completely untenable, and that there is no constituency for it. So we retreat to this vague language of, you know, you need to either make a principled stand, either as an individual, as a community. I mean, there are people who do this. There are many of them who live in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania. They're called Amish. The Hutterites out in North Dakota, Montana, Alberta, they're doing it. They are living the dream. There are ashrams that you can go to in the Himalayas, and they don't have any of these problems. Like, it is there. Kierkegaard used to say that people hardly ever make use of the freedom they have, and that is absolutely 100% true in this case.
And I think in fairness, people are just uncertain about what to do because the technology has advanced at a speed that's outpaced our ability to think through it deeply. And people are rightly frustrated and they want someone to do something. I mean, to me, this is another example of what Thomas Sowell would call a sort of do something impulse, right? We have a problem and we don't know how to solve it. So we need the government to just do something and just do something, right? Figure out a way to stop it, figure out a way to somehow retard it. Rather than deeply thinking through ways to exercise and practice wisdom and to cultivate community norms that allow us to see the technology, to let it advance, but not have it affect us, right? We have power and we have capacity and agency to not let these things rule us, and thinking that it's only government coercion and the power of the state that can keep us wise, to me, is a fallacy. And every time we try it, it absolutely abysmally fails.
The final paragraph of this piece, all Americans have a role to play in resisting this tyranny, which is such a tendentious argument. In our families and our communities, we must work to create more tech-free spaces rather than more tech-dependent ones. And in politics, we must fight it using all the tools of public policy at our disposal. So again, back to the points that you were making. The thing that I can't get away from in all of that is I go back to the famous quote from Milton Friedman that a lot of the objection to a free market is that it gives people what they want rather than what a group of people think that they ought to want. And that is just rife throughout this piece. This idea that Brad Littlejohn and Claire Morrell have figured out what people should want and the way that they should live. And even the way that they phrase this, in our families and in our communities, we must work to create more tech-free spaces rather than more tech-dependent ones. As if the kind of things they're describing in the beginning of the piece, QR codes for menus, which again, I'm not a big fan of either, but on the flip side of that restaurant experience, the QR code where I can pay my bill without having to break my credit card out, I'm in favor of that. I'm in favor of paper menus. The parking experience that they detailed, as if these aren't companies that are responding to the reality that the vast majority of people who own a mobile phone own a smartphone device, who have made that consumer choice and are catering to an enormous segment of the market who wishes to have their experiences be a little bit more efficient, processed through a device that they're perfectly fine and comfortable using. I have no problem whatsoever. As I noted before in earlier in this conversation, one of my very good friends has a dumb phone. Sometimes there's a little unreliability. If I text him, it's just easier to call him. But he's one of those people that doesn't get bothered by the fact that you made a phone call rather than texting him. He has chosen to operate in such a way. He doesn't wish to inflict that on everybody else, especially, again, when the vast majority of people who have decided to engage in the mobile phone market have chosen to do so with a smartphone. The dumb phones are available. People largely don't pick them. Again, the market is revealing what these people actually want rather than what a group of people, or a couple people in this case, think that they ought to want. And I would even encourage putting phones down, putting them away at dinner. There are things you can do within your family. And I think this is, Anthony, to your point, this is the point that I make when it comes to the social media conversations all the time, which is I think there are real problems that exist here. A lot of it is the fact that it is so young, that we have still yet to really figure out how we are going to live with the existence of these kinds of platforms and technologies, and we're working through it. And if you do not have a long-term perspective on this life and this world, and think if we don't fix it right now, it is just going to be chaos and Armageddon in the near future, yeah, it's going to lead you to do some very rash and ill-considered things. Part of fixing these things, part of figuring out how to live better with these forms of technologies, we change them as they change us, is just taking time. And there's a lot of impatience surrounding this conversation about the amount of time that it is going to take. I want to touch very briefly on Neuralink before we go, because this is a remarkable technology story. From the Wall Street Journal, Neuralink's first patient is stepping into the spotlight. Noland Arbaugh, a 29-year-old diving accident victim and quadriplegic from Arizona, gave his most extensive account yet of his experience as the first person to receive Neuralink's brain-computer implant. He spoke glowingly about his experience and crack jokes during a nearly hour-long video posted to X on Friday, which showed him speaking to Neuralink employees during a visit to the company's headquarters a few weeks ago. He talked about everything from playing video games using only his thoughts to what advice he would give future patients. This is, to me, remarkable. I think the dystopian idea of a chip being planted into your brain, look, I still have some concerns about that as well. But what you saw in this video and that this man is able to do because of this advance in technology is a remarkable, wonderful thing. I'm kind of fascinated to see where the development of this technology goes. I even heard Rich Lowry on the National Review Editors podcast talking about with the smartphone stuff in a different nature conversation. I think they were talking about TikTok. It's like I always kind of wondered, like, you know, if you wanted to know like what's the score of the Yankees game, you would just you have the chip in your head. You just think about it. Score flashes up in front there and you're done. You've got your score. You don't need to check it on a device. I can't wait to find out what the authors of that national affairs piece will think of that. But this is a remarkable technological development for somebody, you know, again, a quadriplegic from a diving accident. The ability to do these things with just his thoughts, that's incredible. Absolutely incredible.
I think this is one of those things that, I mean, there's wonderful advantages to this. We have been putting chips in people's circulatory systems for a long time. They're called pacemakers, and they keep people alive in ways that are remarkable every day. These machines will monitor people's hearts for arrhythmias, for stoppages, and they will deliver voltages to keep that circulatory system running great. A lot of people are more uneasy about chips in the brain because they believe that the brain is somehow more the person than the rest of the body is. I mean, there are people who have principled objections to Neuralink who also have principled objections to pacemakers. But that's not the vast majority of people. I think a lot of this anxiety is misplaced because people reduce themselves to the mind. And because there is, even among so many religious people today, a sort of materialism underneath. And I think that when you see, you know, things like, for instance, you know, people having spinal damage who are unable to use their legs, who through technology like this are able to bypass those nervous systems to, let's say, engage the legs directly with their mind, that is a wonderful, amazing thing akin to what we see in these heart monitors, pacemakers. We're just developing this technology now to address nervous system issues, which I think is wonderful.
And I think in fairness, I mean, people are also worried about if you put a chip in, will the government control us? Will a man control me? Will the Russians and the Chinese hack the system and turn us all into whatever sort of bots for the regime?
Oh, no. I saw the Queen of Hearts.
Exactly. And so there are some concerns about, hey, if we put this in there, who's going to be behind the other side of the keyboard directing this thing, which is completely legitimate. And again, it's just new. And I'm really hopeful in terms of what the technology can do for those who've suffered all sorts of medical problems. And I'm really encouraged and excited about some of those applications. To me, it just really speaks to the need to have sort of mature and really well-read ethicists on boards of these companies to be a part of these development conversations. And the idea that we can move ahead with these developments and not have real ethicists to be a part of the conversations, to me, is a fool's errand. We're going to have people in the room during the research and development phase to help people think about the implications of what could happen, and to think really strategically about how we develop these technologies in light of the human person and in light of the need for more wisdom.
Let's call it a wrap there. Thank you for listening to Act and Unwind. If you're listening to this podcast on our website, please look right now in the show notes for a link where you can subscribe directly to Act and Unwind, or just search Act and Unwind on your favorite podcast app. Also, please rate and review us on that evil monopolistic Apple Podcasts, 5-star reviews only, so that more people can find our show. Thanks to Anthony. Thanks to Dan. For the Acton Institute, I'm Eric Cohn. We'll see you next week.